Tricia, if you want to go ahead and start, and Patrick, that would be awesome. Just kind of explain your situation, and then we'll hit Russ for a little bit, and then we'll open it up for questions.
We're talking about drought as it pertains to the yearling operation, I guess. And like Holly said, you know, we were cow calf for a lot of years, putting up dryland hay. We don't have any irrigation or anything like that. It was all dryland hay and you know, grazing on a lot of BLM and native rangeland and some improved pastures and things like that for forever. And then in 2017, we went to Missouri to a ranching for profit school and just kind of had our minds opened up a little bit to some other options. And we came home that fall and sold off the cow herd in November. They went down the road and we just decided they were too big and they just needed too much feed, you know, and on a year like this, or like actually that we've had for the last couple of years, that's proven to be a pretty good decision. I guess I feel like one of the main benefits to having the yearlings is the flexibility that you get with it. You can choose when you buy them, you can choose when you sell them. Granted, there's the market affects your decisions, but at least it's not quite as cumbersome when you have to destock. It's just a lot easier to destock a few head at a time or whatever you need to do. So, and manage your pastures that way.
So yeah, that's kind of what we've been doing. We rolled in a lot of calves here at the end of April. They were going out to grass the middle of May this year and we had no rain. So by the 15th of June, we're already destocking. And by the 1st of July, still no rain. So we destocked some more, very liquidable. Having yearlings, got to the end with the last of them, grazed our hay crops, grazed our cover crop, which, you know, it was a tough year all the way around, but everybody made the comment to me, well, you're lucky because you got yearlings, you can sell them whenever you want. Well, yeah, I got to agree with that, but we also put ourselves in that position to where we could do that. So, you know, if we're in cow calves right now, it'd be a tough situation as far as the hay, the cost of the hay. So I feel like, you know, we're ahead of the game by doing what we're doing. You know, our water holes are all dry. We've developed some water here this fall, still got a ways to go, but yeah, I mean, we're basically out of cattle right now, and until we get some moisture, I'm not ready to stock the ranch. We were able to manage our pastures by destocking earlier to save some grass in them, so I'm excited about that. So when the opportunity comes, you know, we can probably buy back earlier or ahead of everybody else. So quite a few advantages to having yearlings, I think. Way less overhead cost. We're basically running about 3 to 4 times more for half the amount of time and don't have to spend all winter feeding the cows. Don't have to spend all summer putting up the hay. And it was a good decision 4 years ago, I guess, on our part. Might not be for everybody, but it also allows us to intense graze on our hay fields and then in the fall on our cover crop with high stock density, and it's fun to do. Yearlings may be a little more high risk, but you know, there's high reward in it too. So I guess that's just kind of what we've seen about it anyway. So if anybody has any questions, don't be afraid to ask. I'll try to help you out the best I can, but
And it really was a transition. It's not like we just jumped straight into stockers. We liked our cows, you know, we liked calving, we liked all that. So it was really kind of a mental block. We got the cows down the road, but then the next year we're buying back bred heifers and the plan was to sell those that fall as bred heifers. Well, then the market on bred heifers kind of fell out that fall. So we sold about half of them and ended up keeping half of them. And what do you know, we're back in the cow-calf operation again, which was fine. I mean, it all worked out fine, but it just kind of cemented our plan that we needed to get out of this model and switch to something different. So then, you know, we calved those out and sold them as pairs the next year. And then we made the full leap into stockers after that, I guess. And we've done it a few different ways. You know, we've kind of been learning as we go. There's been a lot of learning as we go on this. You know, the 1 year we had a plan to buy them in the spring, but then we had some cheap hay available. We called it cheap hay and thought we could buy some calves at a good price. And so we started feeding them through the winter, you know, because you can feed way more calves than you can cows. And it worked out all right, but it was a lot more labor intensive than we ever imagined it was going to be. And just learned some more. We learned all about disease in weaned calves. You know, there were just more than we ever thought we would ever need to know, and had a lot more death loss than we imagined. It wasn't out of range by any means. I mean, it's kind of what we predicted, but it's still, when you're running those higher volumes, you know, if you're talking 10% death loss, that's just a larger number of dead animals on the ranch. And, you know, that takes some getting used to mentally, I guess, and you're doctoring all the time. And so, you know, we learned from that. The next year we waited until late, like in May to start, or well, I guess maybe April, May to start buying. So those calves didn't set foot on the ranch until several months later than the next year. And that was a good decision. You pay a little more for them, but you're not buying the dead calves and not having to doctor your way through that. I mean, it's, you kind of have to look at what your resources are and, you know, in time and money and just water, everything, and make the best decisions you can. And then I guess this last year, one of the things that we've learned, we threw ourselves into learning, I guess, is how to protect ourselves from the markets and, you know, and buying futures and things like that, which that was a big learning curve too. And it worked well for us. So there's ways to protect yourself in any situation, but you have to put the work in to research it and learn all you can about it.
This is Butch Gillespie. If I can jump in, do you retain ownership then, or through the feedlot? I'm just curious.
No, we haven't. We haven't gone that far yet. Most of the calves, you know, we're buying them, kind of forward contracting them for April, May delivery, and then they'll go out August, September. So no, we haven't retained them all the way through yet.
Other than there's a handful of them that we've kept back that we've fattened as beef, and that's a whole nother enterprise that we're kind of dabbling in. But yeah, otherwise, no.
So Russ, do you want to kind of tell your story and then sure. We'll open up for more questions?
Yeah, no, thanks. I enjoyed listening to that. My story is kind of similar. In fact, I was interested to hear that it was ranching for profit that got you guys thinking different. 25 years ago, when I was a vet in Helena, a client of mine went through ranching for profit, and he came and told me about it, and I became a convert. And that totally changed my thinking and started me on the road that I'm on. I mean, yeah, you start looking at things as a business. You know, I grew up on a cow-calf operation. That's all I ever knew. When I came back and took over after getting interested in the ranching for profit and everything, I knew I always hated machinery. I never could fix it. I hated it. So I said, when I come back, and I said, Dad, sell the hay and equipment. I'm going to graze everything. And he thought I was nuts. But I started doing it just like you. I made plenty of mistakes, but I also learned as I went along. And as cow-calf, for the first few years, but then for all the reasons you said, I just kind of started transitioning into yearlings. And this would have been back in 2003, so 18, 20 years ago or so. And then over the course of a couple of years, I transitioned, and then I've been probably full yearlings, I don't know, 15, 16 years now. And a lot of the reasons I did it are what you said. And then also on my ranch, I have a lot of up and down country. And those cows, they just wouldn't graze those high areas. I could put the salt up there, put protein tubs, whatever. Where a yearling, I mean, that's what they're doing. I always tell people they're like kids in a shopping mall. I said, they just got to go see what's up high and they'll just cover the ground. And for me, they're just a lot more efficient. And same thing also, you can run, you know, 2 to 3 yearlings, you know, for a cow-calf pair and just penciling it out. For me, it's just been better. My overhead's much, much lower. And I'm a one-man operation. I have 3 kids. They were home to help me when they're growing up, but they got jobs quickly and they're all gone now. And so I pretty much have to do things. And with yearlings, I can do it by myself most of the time. The other, I rotationally graze everything. I bring in, depending on the year, 1,300 to 1,500 yearlings. And let me backtrack a little bit. I've owned them all. I've owned part of them. And many years I own none of them, and I'm just contract graze. In the last 4 or 5 years, I've just been contract grazing. I've realized I'm better at grazing them than I am at owning them. The risk, looking at the market, playing the futures, I usually do it wrong. And so I just decided I'm better at grazing and putting on weight than I am at owning them. I like it better. I've had a couple of real good clients. I get one iron cattle, but I'll run about 1,100 head out on the dry land, and I'll rotationally graze those. And then I run about 200 head down here underneath a couple of pivots on 100 acres. And I'll rotationally graze those. That's more poly wire, moving them every, the ones at the ranch, what I call the ranch, which is the dry land place, they'll still get moved every day, two, third day maybe, but they're just bigger fields with more permanent. I have a lot of electric fence. Everything I do is with electric fence. And one thing with yearlings, even on my ranch, which is the dry land west of Sims here, which is about 5,500 acres, over the course of the first couple of years, I actually ran a one wire electric fence around the entire perimeter, just inside the barbed wire fence. Because otherwise with yearlings, you're gonna wear out your horse riding the neighbors and everything. But that one wire electric fence, I train them within a couple of days. And everything I do then is with just one wire electric fence out at the dry land. It's permanent fence. In here, it's more poly wire. You know, one thing, if you're gonna run, I run everything as one mob. And so you gotta have a lot of water. And so not every place would have that, but I've developed, if there's a drop of water, I catch it. I mean, we have good springs. I put in ponds. I was real fortunate. My dad developed springs and he taught me how to do it. And so he already had a good start. And then I just took it kind of the next deal. And so I have lots of water. So when I contract graze, I'll bring them in around the 20th of April, which is earlier than most people. And I'm able to do that because I destock either in August or the first part of September. So I have all that fall growth. And so I'll bring them in on old grass. And the clients like that because it gets them out of their backgrounding lot or whatever, feeding hay. And then, like I said, I'll run them until either August or about Labor Day or whatever, depending on the deal. Incoming weight is important. The lighter they are, the better they are, or the better they'll do. And you want to make sure if you're contract grazing or whatever, that you have an incoming weight limit. Because what you and I think of a yearling, someone else, they'll ship in 900 pounders when you're thinking 650 pounders. And obviously that 900 pounder will eat a lot more. One of the big advantages, I kind of smiled when you said a couple of things. It's nice to have time off. I grew up on a very conventional ranch, and you know, go to ranching for profit, and they talk about, why don't kids want to come back to the ranch? Well, why should they? They see their parents work, 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 starve, starve, starve. I mean, that's the way it is. I heard you mention the word fun. I use that word too. Ranching is fun again. When I was growing up, it wasn't fun. It was work. You can love it, but it's just, and right now I have three kids. Two of them have expressed interest in coming back to the ranch. And I guess that would, you know, we'll see how life works. But yeah, you know, I think that's a mark of success. Because so many, my neighbors, they're like, we don't know what we're going to do. The kids don't want to come back. And I just, so anyway, yearlings for me has worked well, you know, so I'd be glad to answer any questions, but kind of a similar story to you guys. So.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned something that jogged something in my mind too, when you talked about how you run them in one mob. That's been our goal, to run them in one mob. But one wall that we did run into was, and I think it's probably mostly just our office here, but the BLM wasn't exactly on board with that. And so we still have a few mountains to climb there to get them all in one mob. So the early part of the season, typically they're split up, kind of running more set stock than we'd like, but that's just all we can do right now.
Mine's either all deeded or a little bit of state lease. But I was telling Holly before we started here, I bought a ranch in eastern Montana with a few partners 20 years ago by Miles City. That was my first experience with BLM, and we were going to run it just like this. And after 2 years with the BLM, I said, I will never, ever own another ranch and have to deal with the BLM. And I haven't. Yeah. So you're up against, yeah, I don't envy you.
And I don't think every office is that way. I know Craig and Connie have talked about their experiences with BLM, and they've had really good luck, and they're just one county over. But
yeah. That was my experience. If you got the right person, they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. And what I found is the young people were excited by what we were doing, and they got hammered by the people higher up, and they got beaten down. And I decided I wasn't going to have the success of my operation be based on who happens to be the field person. So yeah, that's a frustrating deal. So And I don't know the answer.
Well, maybe over time we'll wear them down.
So I have a question for you guys really quick. So when you're buying that late in the spring and that large in numbers, where are you finding them? Are you going through the sales, or do you have private people that you just purchased their calves from?
We were kind of a forward contractor throughout the winter, different guys that are feeding calves. I have a neighbor that he likes to feed calves all winter, so we kind of forward contracted them. You know, we'll buy some off the video auctions that are later delivery cattle. I got guys that'll put them together for me throughout the winter, and I just tell him what I want them to weigh and what's it going to cost me. And, you know, you lock them up with some down payment money, and I don't want these calves in here until, you know, the end of April, 1st of May, and they're fine with that. You know, next year we're looking at, you know, a way later turnout, so we're going to have some moisture first this winter and whatnot, but kind of what we've been doing. Year before, we bought them all ourselves through sale rings, order buyers, put them all together throughout the winter. I had one guy tell me when I first started this, he said, wait until spring so your money's not tied up for another 5-6 months. And so I did the opposite. I went and tied my money up and suffered some death loss in that deal. But he was right in the end. I can see where he was coming from with that, you know. So that's kind of what we've been trying to do here last year, is just kind of forward contracting them somehow. So I know, you know, this is part of a drought deal, and I've had a lot of people ask me about selling cows, getting into yearlings, and it might work. And then again, it might not. I don't know next spring what yearlings are going to be worth. And there's still, you know, the biggest fear, everybody is finding enough yearlings, but it seems like there's so many cattle out there, you'll find them one way or another. What it's going to cost, I don't know, but this will maybe protect yourself on paper a little bit that way, calls and put options, but we haven't done that quite yet. I missed the bottom here a couple weeks ago, so we can still maybe get into that a little bit, but kind of where we're at. What do you think, Russell? What do you do there?
Well, see, that's the nice thing about just contract grazing. I mean, I used to do a little bit of everything you say. And so now just contract grazing, my client puts all the cattle together. They're sales, mostly sales barn cattle, but he puts them together in the fall. But they're totally straightened out by the time they get to my place in the spring. I mean, they're not green, and they're green as far as feed wise, but I mean, there's the death, they're already straight over the sickness and everything. But it is a tough problem, because I found is when I wanted, if you didn't forward contracting or put them together yourself over the winter, you're trying to buy them in the spring when everybody else is, and boy, you're paying a premium. And it was pretty steep to overcome that premium. Because it's nice not having to winter, but sounds like you're doing a pretty good job of spreading your risk. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we're still not very experienced at this.
Where do you monitor the forward prices for the yearlings?
Kind of, you know, off the futures board is kind of what we've been looking at. But, you know, there's a cash price, and then there's the futures. You know, if I can set a price and look at my futures out in August, September, that's kind of where we're basing it on, basically. It, you know, it's pretty close. You can protect yourself by doing that. Buy some August puts when the price is good. So another thing is LRP, livestock risk protection. You know, there's some guys that's been using that. It's done nothing but cost me money so far, but that's why I basically like to put options. I can get out of them anytime I want to when I can make a profit. The LRP is based on one date, the end date of that contract. And it's basically a put option. But government subsidizes like 30 or 40% of the premium. But so far I haven't, you know, it's protected us, but I haven't made any money on it. So I think I'm done with the LRP. One thing, you know, Russell was talking about, custom grazing. That's something, you know, we're kind of looking more into for next year. If, you know, we don't get any moisture, but come April, May, if we do get some moisture, we're still looking at a later turnout date. So, you know, that could be a huge opportunity for us next year. I mean, everybody's needing grass, everybody's needing hay. So, you know, and that's way less risk in that. Might not be as much money in it, but there's way less risk in it. So, let somebody else buy the high-priced calves. I'll just graze them, put the weight on them. Yeah. Basically, in the end, that's all you're selling is your grass anyway. So,
yes, I agree with that. That's what I finally decided is you're not going to hit the highs doing the custom grazing, but it's a lot less risk. And it's kind of, other than total destocking and a drought, I have a very good idea about what my income's going to be, you know, year to year. And I just keep my expenses in, you know, I may not hit a home run, but I'm also not going to go broke. So.
Mm-hmm. How do you get into that grazing, the contract grazing market?
How do you get into it?
Yeah, how do you get connected to that?
If you let word out slightly that you have grass, your phone will ring off the hook. But I mean, and seriously, if you want to contact me privately, I mean, I'll give you a few numbers or depending. Where are you located?
I'm south of Helena, about 40 miles.
Yeah, everybody's looking for grass. I mean, it's just like anything else. I mean, some people are easier to work with than others or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I made mistakes early on. I mean, I had a place in Miles City, which was totally new country for me. And I got tangled up with the guy who everybody in the country knew you shouldn't get tangled up with, except for me, because I was new. So that was an expensive experience. But yeah, I mean, once you have going to contract grazing business, you'll never have to advertise. People are always calling you because everybody's looking for grass. So,
Just about like selling hay right now.
Yeah.
You got grass, you'll fill it. If you got hay to sell, you'll sell it.
Yeah. And kind of the contract grazing deal, it would be kind of like the hay market now. I mean, there's two ways to approach it. Like, you could about name your own price this spring for grass. But I have a long-term client who, you know, he's with me maybe in a year, he could get it cheaper and he sticks with me. And so, you know, it's just like some people might sell their hay at $300 a ton this year, but then, you know, if they have a long-term deal, they might sell it for $185 because the guy comes back every year. So anyway, kind of evens out in the long run.
This is Craig French. This is mostly probably for Russell with the contract grazing. Uh-huh. I've heard a theory that if you do take in cattle, that you may want to have for the first month, a monthly charge until your animal adjusts, and then weigh them after that first month, and then go into your per month charge. Is there any per daily gain or just per month charge, depending on how you do it? But is there any validity to that theory?
Yes. I've never worked it quite that way, but I'll kind of tell you the way mine did. For probably the first at least 10 years that I did this, I charged strictly on the gain. I got paid so much per pound of gain. And I would weigh them every month, the whole bunch. I mean, whether I was running 1300 or 1500, I have a good scale, a Rockwell scale, and we would weigh the whole bunch once a month. I liked that because I got paid every month. It was as close as you're going to get to a regular job as far as a paycheck coming in. Okay. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I got a little feedback there. So anyway, but by weighing them every month, what I was able to do was I was really able to document and get a history of how the cattle will gain each month on my place. So this is getting back to your question. The first month I made not much money, the first 30 days, and I'd be bringing them in here the middle of April, which is earlier than most, but they're basically eating old grass and a little bit of crested wheat or cheat grass coming up. And those cattle would only gain half to three quarters of a pound a day because they're kind of getting straightened out and everything. So the first check wouldn't be much, but from May 15th to July 15th, and I'm, you know, on this short grass, you know, east slope of the Rocky Mountains country, I'd say I was printing money. Those cattle would gain per day 3 to 4.5 pounds a day. And one guy who I ran him for, you guys recognize the name, but I won't say it. I mean, he fed out a lot of cattle and he's an old guy and he's a good guy. And he just, the first year or two, he just couldn't believe it. Cause he goes, they won't gain that in a feedlot. And I just said, well, they're good cattle. And anyway, and then, so for about 2 months, they're just pouring on the weight, 3 to 4 pounds a day. And then from July 15th, when it heats up and that grass starts getting dry, to to about the first part of August, they'll cut back to 2 pounds a day. And then what I found is that in August, when it's really hot till September, they don't gain very well at all, no matter how good the feed is. It'll be under 2 pounds a day, maybe a pound and a half. So the way I figured it, and this is kind of a long-winded answer to your question, it kind of evened out so that over the course of the summer, they'd gain 2.2 to 2.5 pounds per day. But it really taught me that if I'm charging by the pound of gain, I'd give them that slow first month because I figure they're getting lined out and stuff and just getting primed to really gain for June and July. But I learned that if I was charging by the pound, that I was basically working for free in August because they didn't gain. And that's why I would typically ship them about the 1st of August, but they weighed 1,000 pounds already anyway. So the client was happy to ship them. Now, what I've done the last few years is because I got the same client, we know how much they're going to gain and everything else. We've just basically taken what they would gain on the average, and we've just converted that into a monthly fee. I've done that for two reasons. One is just kind of simpler. I don't have my kids at home. And even though I might weigh them twice a summer, I don't weigh them every month. It eliminates weighing them once or twice. But the other reason is, and this gets back to if you're charging by the game, you end up playing a little bit of a game about the incoming weight. Because obviously if you're charging by the gain, the lighter they are when they come in or the more shrunk, the more weight you're going to have versus if they load them up on feed and water and ship them in so they have 50 pounds of feed in them, then, you know, they shrink that off and your first month and a half, you're feeding them for free because it's just shrink. And I had a client do that one time. And so it was always kind of like, what's fair? If they're shipping in, what weight is it when they leave or when they arrive? So anyway, so that's another reason I kind of went to a monthly deal with this client with this long-term deal. So does that answer your question or did I just confuse you? You're suggesting about charging by the month, the first, that would be a fair way and a good way to do it. I guess it depends then what you're charging by the pound. If you could get a client who might say, well, I don't want to give you the best of both worlds. I don't want to pay by the month when they're not gaining much. And then when they're gaining a lot, you're going to charge me by the pound and charge me a premium. So anything's negotiable. Yeah. So
I have a question to both of you. So Russell, you've been in it for quite a while. What's been the high and low in terms of what the client ends up paying for the cost of putting the pound on their animals?
Oh, when I first started, I think I charged in the low 30s. And then now if you figure it out on a per pound deal, it's more like 40 to 45 cents. There's a little bit of caveats in there that affect it somewhat, the 40 to 45 cents a pound. Now, when I first started, I think I was at the high end. I think I should be raising my prices here. Like everything else, the last few years it's gone up, but I haven't yet. But so yeah, so that's the answer to your question is, I think right now the rate would be about 40, 45 cents a pound of gain.
And how about Trish and you guys, what do you think is costing you to put a pound on?
That's not what it's costing me. That's what I'm charging.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. But in terms of when you're actually buying calves,
yeah,
how's that working economically in terms of what's that gain costing to you?
You know, last year was a pretty decent year on our yearlings, what they come in weighing, what they ended up weighing in August, September. This year, kind of a total wreck, but we made it through there with about the 900 yearlings into August. We destocked 800 by July. So, you know, I mean, how do you figure that? You know, the first set of calves that went down the road, we basically got our money back. The second set that went down the road, yeah, we made a slim margin, but, you know, as far as what we're doing, we've only really done it for 2 years, so we're still learning. You know, we started out with 1,750 yearlings there, turned out May 15th, and by July 1st, we've already destocked 800 head. So, you know, I don't know. I haven't really figured out that cost of gain, especially on a year like this year.
Totally appreciate, yeah. The situation in just those 2 years. Yeah, I'm just thinking how both of you, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, Russell, you've had a lot of years of experience, but you know, whether you're a cow-calf guy or a yearling guy or a combination of what, we all seem to learn a lot over time. Yeah. It's like, how many mistakes can we afford to still? And so, yeah, I just, you know, I appreciate everybody's, you know, I mean, I'm on this call because I'm just curious, like, and we're mostly cow-calf and we're part of a co-op in which we know kind of what a price of our animal is going to be because we own them all the way to the rail. Yet in a drought situation, I've come to really appreciate that if you have your place fully stocked with pears and you have to destock, that can be an expensive deal. So yeah, there's no black and white answers here, but yeah, this is really, really interesting. And Russell, yeah, I think for your clients, if they can put on a pound for 45 cents, that's pretty good. That's you're doing a great service.
Yeah, no, it's time that I look at things again. I had an interesting talk. I met a guy actually at a meeting, had nothing to do with cattle here. He's from South Dakota and he's a pretty sharp guy. And basically he claims, and I don't think he was full of it. I think he knew what he was talking about, that the guys there for grass for yearling would pay $200 for 4 months for a yearling. And I go, that doesn't pencil. And he goes, no, it really doesn't. But he goes, they'll pay it. So anyway, that's in central South Dakota, he claimed. So I said, well, I'm way too cheap. And he says, yeah, you are.
We're not contract grazing, but I one thing I want to maybe mention is that when you're buying these cattle, it would be worth studying up a little bit on the whole sell buy marketing thing, because really you make your money in the buy on these cattle. You have to buy them right. And there's, you know, of course, a lot of other factors all along the way, but there's a lot of money that can be left on the table if you buy them wrong, I guess.
Yeah, I think the sell by accounting, I'm sure you've read the Gordon Hazard and Bud Williams and all that. And that's an interesting concept to get through, but I think that is the correct way to look at it. But it's hard to get your mind around that a little bit.
Yeah, it is. We went down to Wally's class in Oklahoma and he's talking about buying number two cattle. And I told Wally, all we got in Montana is number one cattle. They're all premium cattle. So tough to make your money in the buy around here. But,
but it can be done.
Somewhat. I mean, you buy seconds and thirds, you might have more death loss than what you'd like to. So there's kind of goes both ways, I guess.
And there's room. Also, when you look at the difference between heifers and steers, I mean, there's some years you might make more on heifers and some years you might make more on steers. So,
yeah. And that's one thing we've been doing is we've been buying all heifer calves in Spain. It takes a lot less money to put together a set of heifers, and the spread seems like it's a lot farther apart than, you know, between the heifers and the steers. And then when you go to deliver them, a gap gets a lot smaller, I feel like. So I guess that's kind of where we're at with that versus the heifers versus the steers anyway.
But I don't think there's a cookie cutter method for any of it. I that's kind of the beauty of you doing yearlings, really, is the flexibility that you gain by just in that sector of the market.
Yeah, the flexibility is good. The destocking, just like this year, I mean, we peeled off the heavies the 1st of August and shipped, you know, a third of the cattle and just made everything a lot easier. So talking about the gain, here's one interesting thing that I found by weighing them. So I run, like I said, about 1,000 head on the dry land, 200 head down here on the irrigated. And the irrigated is on beautiful old hay ground. You know, it's got sandfoin, clover, beautiful hay. They're up to their bellies in hay, moving them every day. And the ones out on the dry land will outgain those cattle every year. Mm-hmm. It's just that hard grass. It'll put the weight on them. And you'll just think, no, these ones in here will do it, and they won't.
What about in August? Did you see the same on the irrigated versus the dry land?
They actually do worse on the irrigated, and it's complete counterintuitive. There was one August, and this is about 10 years ago. I mean, I did a great job of rotational grazing them. I moved them 2 to 3 times a day. They were on lush feed all day, every day. And it was a real hot August. I mean, they got water right there. They're not having to travel for water. They have to walk 100 yards to water. And I think that was a bunch of spayed heifers that year. And at the end of August, and I was getting paid by the gain, I think they put on 8 pounds in August total. So the answer to your question is on the irrigated ground, it doesn't matter irrigated or whatever. When it gets hot in August, they don't do well.
One thing that we do kind of have in our arsenal that we've utilized some is the cover crop grazing. It's definitely a later fall feed, but man, the nutritional value is really good on it and they gain really well on it. So if you have any fallow near you that you could, whether it's your own or somebody else's, if you can get them to plant some cover crops on there, a good variety, a good mix, you know, that might be a viable option also. And for us, it's been pretty affordable feed, and it's just really good quality feed for that time of year.
Is it just a Gabe Brown mix of a little bit of everything? Or what's its, I think that's a great
deal. Yeah, it's a diverse mix. We get it out of Canada, sorghum, millet, turnips, radishes, sunflowers, a lot of diversity in it. Yeah. And by August, this country is completely droughted out, dried up. You know, you might get some later rains, but it kind of gets us through August. We basically stock our native range in May and June, and then we go off of that under our kind of trusted wheat alfalfa hay fields instead of haying it. We graze all that, and that's in July, and then we go on to cover crops in August. So it basically keeps them cattle on a plan of nutrition that keeps them going. But, you know, we're running a lot more numbers. So that hay ground, if you're not grazing it, it's going to be sticks within 30 days. So even like this year, we laid a lot of it down in swaths just to capture the nutritional value. And the cattle still had something to utilize. Otherwise, the hoppers and the drought would have been all sticks. So it got us by. But you kind of got to do that. Otherwise, there's nothing left that for them to eat anyway. So it's been working for us.
So this is Connie French. I've got a question on your health protocol. You guys talked about when you had calves in the winter, you did a lot of doctoring. What about in the summer with your yearlings? Is there any routines, any vaccinations that you give when you do have problems? How do you treat them? We've looked at, with our yearlings, the dart guns. We've set up portable corrals and doctored them just through a corral system, and mainly foot rot is the thing that we've dealt with. But is there anything you guys have found that limits those sort of issues with yearlings?
Well, Russell, you're the vet. You can answer that one.
You want to cut your foot rot by a huge amount and your pink eye, iodized salt. That's the key, is the iodine and the salt. And what I get a custom mix made up, but before I did that, I actually talked with the yearling guy when I first started, and this sounds just kind of Western, but if you have just straight stock loose salt, and then if you buy, it's called ethyiodide, ethyiodide. If you throw two handfuls of that per 50-pound bag of salt, that works just about right. And that will cut your foot rot down and your pink eye dramatically, you know, but unless you're in ground that, I don't know, some swampy ground and stuff, they're going to get more. But I'm really a big believer. So the answer to your question is the iodized salt, but it's not just the iodized salt you buy at Murdoch's. It has to be spiked with this ethyiodide. So, and then as far as for treating them, no, what I do treat, and I used to have a lot more. Now everything comes in well vaccinated, straightened out. I don't have to treat that many, but I do ride them every day. But on average, I might pull one a week, pneumonia usually. And then I just use the typical whatever. I mean, you know, the high price stuff, if they're expensive. And I still use a lot of LA-200 and Bantamine because I'm cheap. And if I'm catching them early, it works on them. So same for foot rots. I use that a lot for foot rot. So
we use a dart gun with Draxxin just because it's easy. And I guess mainly we might have a little run in with pink eye early in the spring, kind of runs its course. Yeah, you might have a few with foot rot, so they get darted with the dart gun, whether it's foot rot or not, but it seems like if you can catch it early, they get over it. And then I guess around our water tanks, you know, if you got a lot of mud around there, I think that can be, you know, spread some of that. So we just try to keep that water source dried out around the tanks, and seems like it helps. And we do feed a lot of all iodized salt and mineral. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think the salt and mineral is important on yearlings, especially.
So, Russell, where do you get your ethyiodide?
I don't think you need a prescription. And I should know this, but I'm a vet, but I don't practice anymore. And I haven't practiced for 20 years. I keep my license up, but I don't. I used to be able to just get it at Con Ed. And if not, you might have to get a prescription from your vet, but I don't think so. You used to be able to just buy it over the counter. And I think you still can just at Con Ed or GTA or whoever. So just throw two handfuls of that for each 50-pound bag of salt. And I did that for years and years.
So another question on health, and I don't mean to take up all your time, but flies, when we're talking about salt, we did put garlic salt out for our yearlings when we had them and seemed to help some, but you know, they still had a few flies. Do you guys pour, treat? What do you do about the parasites?
I have fly tags on mine, and it's interesting you say, because actually my client this year provided me with the garlic salt. And I only have 1 year of anecdotal data, but there were less flies on those cattle this year than any time I've ever seen. And the only thing I did different was the garlic salt that he provided. So on 1 year basis, I think it's helpful, but I'll tell you more in a few years.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, like a lot of Canadians, that are putting garlic in their mineral now, and they all swear by it. So I even know mineral companies in Canada that are adding it in there too, and so must be working.
I think that mineral that he brought with the garlic, I think it comes out of Canada.
What's the rate on the garlic and the salt?
It's pre-mixed when he comes. It's in a bag, so I can't tell you that. It's just a commercial mix.
Half and half. No, it ain't that much. I have no idea.
It smells like garlic. I mean, it isn't just a little bit. It smells good.
We get it by the pallet, and our shop certainly smells like garlic. We shouldn't have any vampires in our shop either. I don't think. We get ours from Redmond, and it comes in a 50-pound sack, and it seems like a pretty good product.
Yeah. Roger and Betsy, are you asleep or what?
No.
I'm not.
Just listen, PJ. No, I think my comment, I got a couple, but one is, I think there might, Russell, I don't know if you're doing, primarily heifers or steers, or is it a mix?
I've done both, but for the last number of years, straight steers.
And I was wondering if there wouldn't be quite an opportunity with the shortage of feed to feed somebody's, you know, to some or somebody's replacement heifers. I think there's a lot of people that would love to put the replacement heifers out somewhere and take that burden off, because they certainly expect the cattle cycles coming up and are trying to keep cows around them.
No, good point. Well taken. Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it would be. Bad thing about running heifers is I'm surrounded by cow calf outfits.
And they're bulls.
Yeah. Yeah. So
if only we knew somebody that raised a good bull that we could put with those heifers.
That's just, yeah, you have to search high and wide, Connie.
Do you have much for shade on them in August? Or I guess I'm just, what's really caused them not to gain? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I have no shade. I don't have any trees. I think it's just in the heat. I mean, they have good water. So I think that it's just too hot. I just don't think that I don't know if they're grazing. I know down on the irrigated ground, I think that feed is just kind of more washy. I mean, I don't know if it's more so than earlier in the spring, but it has to do something with the heat, that their feed intake just isn't as high. So I don't really know the answer to it, but I can tell you, after weighing a lot of cattle for a lot of years, it's a real phenomena, at least on my place.
For what it's worth, there was a great article in Working Ranch magazine, I think last month, and this was in Utah, but a bunch of people there that had BLM ground, actually, like 30 some of them got together. But they were right next to a big allotment that Deseret Ranches had. And they were actually able to convert, they grouped together, and then they were able to convert that, you know, sell the idea and do a grazing plan on the BLM, because they were afraid they were going to lose or reduce their AUM, but it sounded to me like, I don't know anything about it, but there was a lot of people named in the article. I'm pretty sure it was Working Ranch Magazine, and it just sounded like a real success, which could be pretty interesting, especially in areas where there's a lot of it.
Yeah, that was in Working Ranch. I actually read that article. It was a good article.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Well, I think eventually the people's attitudes will start to change. You know, if you're managing your grazing well, I can see where if people think they're just going to get into yearlings and do set stock, or, you know, that can be damaging possibly.
I guess, hey, Russell, this question is for you, I guess, but, you know, we've been looking at if there was some way that we could get, you know, yearlings later on in the year, maybe July. You know, our biggest problem is if we don't get rain in May and June, we have no grass. No grass grows. So our biggest problem is trying to stock this ranch on AUMs. And if it don't rain, we're overstocked. It never seems to rain too much or we have overabundance of grass. But, you know, we're looking at, hey, you know, let's make the grass and then we know how many cattle we can bring in, you know, but we're looking at later in the summer, July, August, you know, maybe we can run them later into November, but at least you'd have some way to measure what you have out there and match it with, you know, the number of cattle. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good thought in theory. I'm like you, I'm not quite sure if the right size cattle are out there for what you need, the numbers you need. That would be the only thing. But, you know, more and more people are, you know, calving later or something, you know, summer calves. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's always cattle if you're looking, I mean, out there. But it would be tougher to stock, I would say, but not impossible. I think it's a good idea. Because, yeah, the biggest thing is, you're trying to stock it and you're trying to guess if it's going to rain or not.
Exactly.
And so that's what, you know, I understock my place and most years I have some left over. And last year I pushed it a little hard, but, yeah, so it's a tough deal. So
even, you know, even farther out into the fall, November, December, and even if you could winter graze a class of livestock, you know, you're looking at, like this year, $300 ton hay. Well, if there's a class of livestock, you know, later calving cows or something, but your forage is already made. So you're looking out there and saying, okay, I have this many pounds per acre. Now figure out the number of cattle. And you could still winter graze a class of livestock and still make pretty good money at it compared to the hay price. You know, it's kind of where my thinking is there.
I think you're on to something, because I've always said that there's an asymmetrical value of grass. Grass in November is more valuable than grass in June when everybody else. I think you could, especially I think this hay deal has maybe woke a few guys up that before wouldn't have considered fall grazing or winter grazing. And now if you can come in, I mean, I'd like to ask this question out there. What would the market be? Because I've actually kind of was thinking a little bit the way you are, that maybe I should be tailoring and kind of changing the way I do. And yeah, graze November and be charging these guys for their cows so much per day. I have one neighbor that I run a few head and it's more as a favor, but it's a good deal for both of us. So
right.
I guess I agree with you. And then I would ask, have you heard what people are paying? I surmise it'd be more cows, you know. What the rate is
for winter grazing?
Yes.
No, I haven't, because nobody winter grazes in this country. They're all feeding hay.
Yeah.
And I look at that to as an opportunity, because now I'm grazing these pastures that's never been grazed at that time of the year, you know, so I'm totally grazing at a different time of the year. So I think that's a huge opportunity for the soil and for the grass. And not only that, but the opportunity for the cost of feed, if I can graze them out versus the cost of hay. I we're just trying to get down that road and figure that out a little bit, I guess, because I would love to rest all my pastures next year and just see how much grass I can grow over the growing season, and then it's all stockpiled for winter forage, you know. So it's just a different way of looking at it, maybe.
Yeah, so maybe you guys should be buying calves in August, first part of September, and run them in fall, winter grazing them. Yeah, I don't, looking outside the box. Yeah.
That is, I just, as far as freshly weaned calf, I you know, you might have some death loss in that, but whether you're wintering cows, pregnant cows, or older yearlings or something, there's just got to be some class of livestock that would fit very well with that without having a huge death loss.
Yeah, I agree.
One time we paid a neighbor for some winter grazing. And if you did the math on, say, $200 a ton hay, and you fed them 40 pounds of hay a day times 30 days, that's $120 per month. So if you could be somewhere less than that, for sure, I think it would be a value. Plus, that's not even fed. That's just the hay.
Right.
So, I mean, if you did it for 100, it would be cheaper for them to do that.
Interesting. You're considering it, PJ, because we're along the same lines. We do plan on being mostly destocked from about June 1 on and seeing how much recovery we can get. And we considered this fall, early winter grazing concept. And so, for example, if it was $30 a month for summer grass, $60 a month for winter hay, maybe $45, somewhere in the middle if you're grazing in the wintertime. That was just something considering.
Right. I guess, and we're really considering that path just because, you know, the BLM's already looking at a June 1st turnout. And, you know, we always talk about overgrazing. It's a function of time. Well, you know, this country needs to be rested, and it needs to be rested for a year or two. I mean, it's, we're just so far behind on moisture right now. So I'm just trying to plan ahead, even farther ahead of the yearling deal. And I guess that's kind of what I've been thinking on that winter grazing, even if it's for, you know, large numbers for 2 months, November, December, but at least I know how much grass was made over the summer. And, you know, I don't really feel like it really affects the plant when you're grazing in the dormant season versus the growing season. So I guess that's where I'm at with that.
We'll let you know in a year and a half what we decided.
I own some yearlings, and even when I was in cow-calf, and I mean, it worked well for me. I mean, on the hay ground, I swath graze some, and some I would just, but I mean, I'd be out there moving my poly wire in a foot of snow, and it worked wonderfully. But that was, you know, for only did it for a couple of years and not huge numbers, but I mean, probably 300 calves or a couple hundred head of cows, and it worked. And actually, you still got sickness and some death loss, but there's a heck of a lot less on, you know, freshly weaned meaning that they've been weaned at least a couple of weeks. The sooner you can get them out on grass, the healthier they're going to be. You get them out of that dusty corral. Yeah. So you still got it, but it's better than it's less than in a corral.
Yeah.
So I have a couple drought related questions. So Russell, it sounds like, were you impacted by the drought at all? It sounds like you've just been doing things just like you've been doing them, and that this year didn't really impact you very much. Is that the
case? Yes and no. It was dry here, but not as bad as what you guys had. We had a mid-May wet snowstorm, and that got us off. And then the middle of June, we had an inch and a half of rain. So it was bad, but it wasn't as terrible as what a lot of the state had. So my place got hit a little harder than usual, but it's still in pretty good shape. And I'd like to think that it's some of it is a result of doing things right for 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think that the organic matter has been built up. I think I hold the water, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I've driven through eastern Montana. I've driven through my neighbors, and most places look worse than mine. And I only shipped about 2 weeks earlier than normal. So, but my place doesn't look as good as I'd like it, but it's not as bad as a lot of places. So does that answer your question? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second question is, so I know a few people, including ourselves, enroll in this federally subsidized range insurance PRF program. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious if you guys have used that program, have looked at the program, have any thoughts about that program. And then I guess anyone else on the call, you know, whether they feel that program, it's kind of, we've learned over 3 years, it's a little more complicated than we thought, though we've made a little bit of money on it. And if it doesn't rain in December.
I'd be interested in hearing what people have to say, because now that you say it, I actually remember when it first came out 10 or 15 years ago. I did it for a year or two. And to tell you the truth, I've completely forgotten about it. I must have quit doing it because I didn't think it worked well for me. And I didn't even know it was out there. So I'd be very curious to hear other people. Yeah. So I'm embarrassed to say that I knew about it and I've completely forgotten about it. So yeah.
No need to be embarrassed. It's that the people who have had quite useful, but it's, you know, how you pick your months and what, you know, how many acres you put in and how much money. It's not just like, yeah, I'm going to get this program, and if I get a drought, I'm going to get a bunch of money. It doesn't work quite like that. So
yeah, there was a lot of decisions you had to make as far as kind of how you were going to structure it. And
December 1st, if you're interested, that's when the deadline is.
Yes, right, yeah.
I'll jump in here real quick. At Stock Growers, they just had their annual convention, and they did have two different people. Errol Rice, he used to be the executive secretary there at Stock Growers, but he sells that insurance, and then they doubled up with a guy by the name of up there in that Denton area, I think it was, that does the puts and the all that stuff on the futures. But they worked the two together. Now, I got in there late on it, and it's kind of the same way. We did it a couple times 10 years ago or more and never could see where it really helped out all that much. So same way, I kind of forgot about it. But by working the two together, you know, maybe there's some possibilities there. It was intriguing, but I'd have to know a lot more about it before I jump into it. But by double teaming it, so to speak, they thought there might be some brilliance in that method. So take that for whatever it's worth.
Yeah, we looked into it, Bill, and I'm still trying to decide. But to me, it's insurance, and you got to pick the right months when it's going to rain, when it's not going to rain. And there's a lot of if, ands, and buts about it. So I don't know. It's kind of like, how bad do you want to buy more insurance, I guess? And the payout wasn't all that great, I didn't think so.
And I think, doesn't it, it's based on the rainfall for your entire county. And in counties like ours, Lane County's fairly diverse geographically. So if one portion of Lane County got some rain and maybe the northern portion didn't, then you were out of luck.
Well, that's not true. There's supposed to be a weather station on every township, but I don't know how they monitor that, because I've been around this country and I've never seen one of their weather stations. So, but they go in grids, I guess. They can pull up the last 30 or 50 years in these grids, and it's kind of your crapshoot roulette table, the thing that says, okay, you know, it's time to hit on black. But that's the way I feel about it. I don't know.
You know, Holly, this probably would be a topic unto itself. There are a few people out there who have really used this program quite effectively, and we've just gotten into it, and it's been useful. But in some respects, it's often sometimes less actually drought insurance, you know, the way you do this. It's more kind of an investment program, and if you work with an agent working with all the various algorithms, it's, you know, they usually get a return. People get a return on investment if they do it properly, but then you can kind of work both ends. But as much time as we put into it, it can be really significant, you know, if you do it well or work with people who do it well, particularly on a year like this. But for tonight, this, you know, obviously this isn't the topic, but I could see down the road for bull sessions, you know, we might put together a good panel of folks and explore this tool. Because it's just one of many tools to try and get through the kind of things we're experiencing this year.
I'd sure be interested in hearing that bull session. Yeah.
Hey, Russ, kind of a question for you. We did this about 4 years. And the first year we bought those twos and threes Patrick was talking about and had pretty significant death loss. We've been buying about 525 pounders. Have you found that there's a sweet spot in the weight that you like to bring in where they gain the best? When they come onto your place, are they a certain weight when they?
Yeah. Actually, that 500 pounder would be about it. Because if they're much smaller than that, you're getting a little too light and too easy to die. But yeah, there's 1 year, and unfortunately I did 1 year just the way the client shipped in, and it seems like I had about 300 head of 400 pounders, 300 head of 500 pounders, and then 600 pounders. And I actually weighed them. I forget how I did it, but I weighed them separately. And those 500 pounders was the sweet spot. Now, unfortunately, it's very tough to get them. I mean, I've tried to have my contracts say, bring those in because I know that I'll make more money off them. They eat less, they gain more. But the guys just tell me, they say, we can't find them in this country because we might, yeah, by the time we winter them and stuff, we can't get them that light that time of year. So, so if I could find them 500 pounders, but in my experience, getting significant numbers, if you can get them 650, you're doing good. So
we know
500 pounders for $4 a pound.
Yeah. We were just joking here. We know how to come up with some light calves.
Okay. That's your eyes. Okay. Yeah. Figure out the formula.
We can maybe get them up to 500 by April.
So
getting back to yearlings versus just taking in cow calf pairs, because it does look like there's going to be a lot of need for that or demand for pasture for cow calf pairs. What are some of the dynamics there? I'm assuming it's mainly just that the cow calf pairs, you probably take a little more forage than it would for the yearlings, obviously, but when you're doing the math on it, the economics, how does that pan out?
Well, here, I'll give you my opinion on it. You can run at least two, if not three yearlings per cow-calf pair. Now, there's a lot of ifs in that, and people go, oh, no way, that isn't, the conversion's 0.75 or whatever. That's... if you really watch your forage, that isn't accurate. And then it depends. You got to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. Back in the day when they were figuring it and cows were 900 pounds and calves are weaned at 350, then maybe the conversion was more accurate. Probably not the people on this phone call, but most of our neighbor ranchers, their cows are going to average 1600 pounds. They calve in 1st of February. The calves are 400 pounds when they go to grass in May, you know, 750 pounds they come off in August. I can run three yearlings for one pair of those. If assuming they're coming in at, you know, 600, 6 1/4. So that's my little spiel on it. And I can tell you just from running them down on this irrigated ground where I could really keep track of numbers and the amount of feed they use and stuff. I mean, I could see it. I mean, pairs versus yearlings. I mean, just how many yearlings you could run compared to the pairs.
So now myself, if I could get enough money for those cow-calf pairs per month, I wouldn't be dealing with near as many head of livestock. That has some appeal. Cows usually don't test the fences quite as much as yearlings do. So that's why I kind of brought the question up. So, but I guess it's all depending on how much money a cow-calf guy is willing to put out to.
So I'll throw that question out there. You guys probably, because I used to follow the cow-calf market pretty good, but I don't pay any attention anymore. What is the going rate that people are paying for AUM for summer range for cow-calf pair?
Well, up here, I've heard 35 to maybe 40, but it seems to me like maybe you might have to have more than that to make a competitive comparison there. That's just my thoughts.
Well, I agree with that, and that's why I went to yearlings in the first place, because that's 20 years ago, it was $30 a cow. Yeah, cow-calf pair. Well, if I was getting 20, 25 for my yearlings, I was making... and it could run three yearlings for a cow-calf pair, the math is pretty easy. And that's, yeah. I guess, and I think you're right. I think a lot of people are only willing to pay that. Now in this drought year, it might wake them up at how much the value of that grass is. I think the going rate should be much higher than that. And if, I think hopefully you can get that now. Hopefully you can get $60 a pair. So.
Kind of where my head was at, but.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry, the lady who did the hay calculation, she was dead on. Yes, these guys should be paying $100 a month for fall grazing their cows or winter grazing, and that's a bargain. Yeah. That's a bargain. If they, but most people don't put a pencil to it, and they love feeding their cows. Doesn't matter whether it's $300 a ton hay, they'll complain more, but they won't feed them any less. And that, by God, they won't pay the neighbor $100 for that month, because they'll, that Robin blankety blank neighbor, but it'd be a bargain. But most people don't put a pencil to it. Okay, I'm off my soapbox.
Mindset with them.
Yeah.
And then you still got to put the diesel fuel in the tractor to feed the hay bale or however you're doing it too. So it's not cheap.
Yeah.
But that's about where we're at up here. 30 is about tops, you know, back when 2013, 14, and then cattle prices went through the roof. Well, then everything else went up, including all of our leases, and we're still there at the 30. So, but I got to agree with Russell on that. If you're $30 for a cow-calf pair and you can run 3 yearlings, well, I guess that's maybe one reason why we're doing what we're doing, I guess. So,
the big reason.
I wonder some, and I haven't really done any calculations on it, but just what we've done some, wintered some dry cows over, and we winter those dry cows really, really cheap, but we achieve 90% utilization. So they run along behind cows. And I mean, so our winter costs are really, really cheap on those. But I wonder if some combination, you know, PJ, like you were talking, maybe you go in with a big bunch of calves or something for November, December, or something like that. But you're going to have some grass that you could winter some dry cows on pretty cheap. I don't know. That's just throwing that out there. You might own those longer. You might end up owning those all the way till the next October or August.
Right.
You know, but I don't know. I know that utilization on certain areas of a property could have some value as long as you're going to rest it long enough behind that.
Mm-hmm. Curious here. Are you saying buy these cows when they're cheap, you know, later October, November, they're like they are right now. They're pretty darn cheap. And then just turn them out there, put some weight on them, and the price normally comes up and you've got extra weight. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, I think my thought would be to take weight off of them through the winter. Just get them to survive and put the weight on them as soon as the grass comes on.
Oh, you'd hold them that long until the next spring. Huh, interesting.
If you've got good feed, you could probably put some weight on them, but depending on the winter, some winters, even with good feed, they might not do too well.
Depending on their shape when you get them.
Right.
Or you could, if they were in decent shape, you could breed them early and then send them somewhere else where they typically calve, you know, at a different time of year than most people here.
Just to show you my sense of timing, I actually decided to do that one year. I bought light cows and was just going to, you know, put some weight on them or whatever, some thin shelly cows and bought them. That was the mad cow year. I bought them and mad cow. So yeah, I have an uncanny sense of timing. So
how did they winter for you though, Russell? Did they winter all right?
Yeah, no, actually they were doing fine until that. And then I actually, whether it was right or wrong, I followed the Bud Williams advice that if you're going to pull the plug, pull it early. And so when that thing hit, I pulled it and I think I probably broke even, but I actually think I agree with everything everybody said about if you read about it and think about it, the only value or the only class of livestock that actually gains in value per pound is a thin cow. So, yeah. And it doesn't take much to get her by. And yeah, so I've often thought that there's real opportunity there. I guess I got stung a little bit that one year and maybe it scared me off, but yeah, I think that there's, and like I said, you could breed some back or yeah. In fact, I've even thought, you know, getting along your line of thinking is that I shouldn't be running these yearlings at all. I should be doing what you're thinking about doing, but buying something like these thin cows and, and they know how to get out and rustle and yeah, they'll do fine. And they're easy to get along with and trained. And I think there's an opportunity there. What's keeping me from doing that now is doing this yearling deal. About 20 years ago, we started going down and living on the beach in Mexico, and I don't want to goof that up. So that's the rest of the story. Yeah, that's why I do things the way I do. So,
for whatever it's worth, it is interesting. For years, we've wintered, especially when we calved in April, why we winter on just native grass and short grass country up here. But 9/10 of a pound of protein on a pregnant cow will do wonders on dry grass as far as keeping them in really, really good shape. It's just, of course, you have to have the vitamins and minerals to go with that, but you feed it as a package, but it flat works. We did it for enough years that I'm totally confident. It's just amazing.
What kind of a product did you use to do that?
Well, I've been in the feed business for a number of years, but not so much with cattle, actually hogs and dairy cows of the Hutterite colonies. But for the protein, I just bought whatever would work, whether it was a camelina meal that had the oil squeezed out of it for, you know, this, you know, biodiesel deal. Distillers, if you can get the right kind of distillers, that can work good. High fat canola can work really good. You know, and most of that runs around 3/10 of a pound of protein or even a little more. So you can feed them. What we did is we just fed them 6 pounds of that every other day or about 3 times a week. And just so you get almost a pound of protein in them a day on the average. They don't need that protein every day, but every second or third day is good enough. But so you can kind of find that, you know, distillers, why over in North Dakota, the best place to buy it. Now, here are some of the feed mills do bring it in. You can buy it bulk there, and that's by far the easiest thing to do. Now, we just mixed it with minerals and vitamins in the back of the pickup. So old-fashioned way, but it works.
Okay, thank you.
Does anybody else have any other questions? We're about at our time. But if you guys want to stay on, I'm more than welcome to stay too. But if there's not any other questions, then we can call it an evening.
From my perspective, thanks a lot for setting this up and doing it. I found it very, very entertaining. So
you do this once a month or once a week, or how often do you do this?
So we try to do it once a month, and we try to pick a topic, like, you know, something like this that's of interest to people that's come up in past bull sessions. Like Bill said, maybe the programs would be a next good one. We just kind of, whatever is kind of going on. We did a drought one that last month. We did like how everybody did in the drought. The month before, we did a winter feed supplement. We've done like the virtual fencing. So we just try to like just do different topics and then let the conversation flow from there. But it seems to work pretty well.
Cool. Thank you.
We've enjoyed it.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. I got a lot out of it. So appreciate it.
Well, thank you for showing up. And Tricia and Patrick, thank you too. Really appreciate your input. So thank you.
Having us.
I'll be tuning in next month. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Have a good night.
Thanks, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.